The obedience of Abraham, which allowed him to become the father of all the tribes of Israel, was precisely what drove Saul into fits of fury. After 55 years of dedicating his life and work to the story of ethical systems, Saul Weintraub had come to a single, unshakable conclusion. Any allegiance to a deity or concept or universal principle which put obedience above decent behavior toward an innocent human being was evil. "So define innocent," came the vaguely amused, faintly querulous voice which Saul associated with these arguments. "A child is innocent," thought Saul. "Isaac was. Rachel is." "Innocent by the mere fact of being a child?" "Yes. And there is no situation where the blood of the innocent must be shed for a greater cause." "No," thought Saul, "none." "But the innocent are not restricted to children, I presume." Saul hesitated, sensing a trap, trying to see where his subconscious interlocutor was heading. He could not. "No," he thought, "the innocent include others as well as children. Such as Rachel, at age 24. The innocent should not be sacrificed at any age." "That's right." "Perhaps this is part of the lesson which Abraham needed to learn before he could be father to the blessed of the nations of the earth." "What lesson?" thought Saul. "What lesson?" But the voice in his mind had faded, and now there were only the sounds of night birds outside and the soft breathing of his wife beside him. Rachel could still read at age 5. Saul had trouble remembering when she had learned to read. It seemed she always had been able to. 4 standard," said Saray. "It was early summer, 3 months after her birthday. We were picnicking in the field above the college. Rachel was looking at her Winnie the Pooh book, and suddenly she said, 'I hear a voice in my head.'" Saul remembered then. He also remembered the joy he and Saray had felt at the rapid acquisition of new skills Rachel had shown at that age. He remembered because now they were confronted with the reverse of that process. "Dad," said Rachel, from where she lay on the floor of his study, carefully coloring, "how long has it been since Mom's birthday?" "It was on Monday," said Saul, preoccupied with something he was reading. Saray's birthday had not yet come, but Rachel remembered it. "I know, but how long has it been since then?" "Today is Thursday," said Saul. He was reading a long Talmudic treatise on obedience. "I know, but how many days?" Saul put down the hard copy. "Can you name the days of the week?" Barnard's World had used the old calendar. "Sure," said Rachel. "Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday." "You said Saturday already."
"Yeah, but how many days ago?"
"Can you count from Monday to Thursday?" Rachel frowned, moved her lips. She tried again, counting on her fingers this time. 4 days.
"Good," said Saul. "Can you tell me what 10 minus 4 is, kiddo?"
"What does minus mean?"
Saul forced himself to look at his papers again.
"Nothing," he said. "Something you'll learn at school."
"When we go home tomorrow?"
"Yes."
One morning when Rachel went off with Judy to play with the other children, she was too young to attend school any longer, Saray said, "Saul, we have to take her to Hyperion." Saul stared at her.
"What?"
"You heard me. We can't wait until she is too young to walk, to talk. Also, we're not getting any younger." Saray barked a mirthless laugh. "That sounds strange, doesn't it? But we're not. The Poulsen treatments will be wearing off in a year or two."
"Saray, did you forget? The doctors all say that Rachel could not survive cryogenic fugue.
No one experiences FTL travel without fugue state. The Hawking effect can drive one mad, or worse."
"It doesn't matter," said Saray. "Rachel has to return to Hyperion."
"What on earth are you talking about?" said Saul, angered.
Saray gripped his hand. "Do you think you're the only one who has had the dream?"
"Dream?" managed Saul.
She sighed,
and sat at the white kitchen table. Morning light struck the plants on the sill like a yellow spotlight. "The dark place," she said. "The red lights above. The voice telling us to go to Hyperion, to make an offering." Saul licked his lips, but there was no moisture there. His heart pounded. Whose name is called? Saray looked at him strangely. Both of our names. If you weren't there, in the dream with me, I could never have borne it all these years. Saul collapsed into his chair. He looked down at the strange hand and forearm lying on the table. The knuckles of the hand were beginning to enlarge with arthritis. The forearm was heavily veined, marked with liver spots. It was his hand, of course. He heard himself say, "You never mentioned it. Never said a word." This time, Saray's laugh was without bitterness. "As if I had to. All those times, both of us coming awake in the dark, and you covered with sweat. I knew from the first time that it was not merely a dream. We have to go, Father. Go to Hyperion." Saul moved the hand. It still did not feel a part of him. "Why, for God's sake? Why, Saray? We can't offer Rachel?" "Of course not, Father." "Haven't you thought about this? We have to go to Hyperion, to wherever the dream tells us to go, and offer ourselves instead." "Offer ourselves?" repeated Saul. He wondered if he was having a heart attack. His chest ached so terribly that he could not take in a breath. He sat for a full minute in silence, convinced that if he attempted to utter a word, only a sob would escape. After another minute, he said, "How long have you thought about this, Mother?" "Do you mean known what we must do? A year, a little more, just after her fifth birthday." "A year? Why haven't you said something?" "I was waiting for you to realize, to know." Saul shook his head. The room seemed far away and slightly tilted. "No, I mean, it doesn't seem... I have to think, Mother." Saul watched as the strange hand patted Saray's familiar hand. She nodded. Saul spent 3 days and nights in the arid mountains, eating only the thick-crusted bread he had brought and drinking from his condenser therm. 10,000 times in the past 20 years he had wished that he could take Rachel's illness, that if anyone had to suffer, it should be the father, not the child. Any parent would feel that way, did feel that way, every time his child lay injured or racked with fever. Surely, it could not be that simple. In the heat of the third afternoon, as he lay half-dozing in the shade of a thin tablet of rock, Saul learned that it was not that simple. Can that be Abraham's answer to God? That he would be the offering, not Isaac? It could have been Abraham's. It cannot be yours. Why? As if in answer, Saul had the fever vision of naked adults filing toward the ovens past armed men, mothers hiding their children under piles of coats. He saw men and women with flesh hanging in burned strips carrying the dazed children from the ashes of what once had been a city. Saul knew that these images were no dreams, were the very stuff of the first and second Holocausts, and in his understanding, knew before the voice spoke in his mind what the answer was, what it must be. The parents have offered themselves. That sacrifice already has been accepted. We are beyond that.
Then what? What?
Silence answered him. Saul stood in the full glare of the sun, almost fell. A blackbird wheeled overhead, or in his vision. Saul shook his fist at the gunmetal sky. You use Nazis as your instruments. Madmen, monsters. You're a goddamn monster yourself.
No.
The earth tilted and Saul fell on his side against sharp rocks. He thought that it was not unlike leaning against a rough wall. A rock the size of his fist burned his cheek. The correct answer for Abraham was obedience, thought Saul. Ethically, Abraham was a child himself. All men were at that time. The correct answer for Abraham's children was to become adults and to offer themselves instead. What is the correct answer for us? There was no answer. The ground and sky quit spinning. After a while, Saul rose shakily, rubbed the blood and grit from his cheek, and walked down to the town in the valley below.
No, Saul told Saray, we will not go to Hyperion. It is not the correct solution.
You would have us do nothing, then?
Saray's lips were white with answer, but her voice was firmly in control.
No. I would have us not do the wrong thing.
Saray expelled her breath in a hiss. She waved toward the window where the 4-year-old was visible playing with her toy horses in the backyard.
Do you think she has time for us to do the wrong thing, or anything, indefinitely?
Sit down, Mother. Saray remained standing. There was the faintest sprinkling of spilled sugar on the front of her tan cotton dress. Saul remembered the young woman rising nude from the phosphorescent wake of the Motal Isle on Maui Covenant.
We have to do something, she said.
We've seen over 100 medical and scientific experts. She's been tested, prodded, probed, and tortured by 2 dozen research centers. I've been to the Shrike Church on every world in this web. They won't see me. Melio and the other Hyperion experts at Rikes say that the Shrike cult has nothing like the Merlin sickness in their doctrine, and the indigenes on Hyperion have no legends of the malady or clues to its cure. Research during the 3 years the team was on Hyperion showed nothing. Now research there is illegal. Access to the time tombs is granted only to the so-called pilgrims. Even getting a travel visa to Hyperion is becoming almost impossible. And if we take Rachel, the trip may kill her.
Saul paused for breath, touched Saray's arm again.
I'm sorry to repeat all this, Mother, but we have done something.
Not enough, said Saray. What if we go as pilgrims?
Saul folded his arms in frustration. The Church of the Shrike chooses its sacrificial victims from thousands of volunteers. The web is full of stupid, depressed people. Few of these return.
Doesn't that prove something? Saray whispered quickly, urgently. Somebody or something is preying on these people.
Bandits, said Saul. Saray shook her head.
The golem.
You mean the Shrike?
It's the golem, insisted Saray, the same one we see in the dream.
Saul was uneasy. I don't see a golem in the dream. What golem?
The red eyes that watch, said Saray. It's the same golem that Rachel heard that night in the Sphinx.
How do you know that she heard anything?
It's in the dream, said Saray, before we enter the place where the golem waits.
We haven't dreamed the same dream, said Saul. Mother, why haven't you told me this before?
I thought I was going mad, whispered Saray.
Saul thought of his secret conversations with God and put his arm around his wife.
Oh, Saul, she whispered against him, it hurts so much to watch, and it's so lonely here.
Saul held her. They had tried to go home. Home would always be Barnard's world. 6 times to visit family and friends. But each time the visits were ruined by an invasion of newsteeps and tourists. It was no one's fault. News traveled almost instantaneously through the mega-datasphere of 160 web worlds. To scratch the curiosity itch, one had only to pass a universal card across a Terminex disky
and step through a Farcaster. They had tried arriving unannounced and traveling incognito, but they were not spies, and the efforts were pitiful. Within 24 standard hours of their re-entry to the web, they were besieged. Research institutes and large med centers easily provided the security screen for such a visit, but friends and family suffered. Rachel was news.
"Perhaps we could invite Tetha and Richard again," began Saray.
"I have a better idea," said Saul. "Go yourself, Mother. You want to see your sister, but you also want to see, hear, and smell home. Watch a sunset where there are no iguanas. Walk in the fields. Go."
"Go? Just me?"
"I couldn't be away from Rachel."
"Nonsense," said Saul. "Twice in 20 years, almost 40, if we count the good days before. Anyway, twice in 20 years doesn't constitute child neglect. It's a wonder that this family can stand one another. We've been cooped up together so long."
Saray looked at the tabletop, lost in thought.
"But wouldn't the news people find me?"
"I bet not," said Saul. "It's Rachel they seem to key on. If they do hound you, come home. But I bet you can have a week visiting everyone at home before the teeps catch on."
"A week," gasped Saray.
"I couldn't. Of course you can. In fact, you must. It will give me a few days to spend more time with Rachel. And then when you come back, refreshed, I'll spend some days selfishly working on the book."
"The Kierkegaard one?"
"No. Something I've been playing with called The Abraham Problem."
"Clumsy title," said Saray.
"It's a clumsy problem," said Saul. "Now go, get packed. We'll fly you to New Jerusalem tomorrow so you can cast out before the Sabbath begins."
"I'll think about it," she said, sounding unconvinced.
"You'll pack," said Saul, hugging her again.
When the hug was completed, he had turned her away from the window so that she faced the hallway and the bedroom door.
"Go. When you return from home, I'll have thought of something we can do."
Saray paused.
"Do you promise?"
Saul looked at her.
"I promise. I will. Before time destroys everything. I swear, as Rachel's father, that I'll find a way."
Saray nodded, more relaxed than he had seen her in months.
"I'll go pack," she said.
When he and the child returned from New Jerusalem the next day, Saul went out to water the meager lawn while Rachel played quietly inside. When he came in, the pink glow of sunset infusing the walls with a sense of sea warmth and quiet, Rachel was not in her bedroom or the other usual places.
"Rachel?"
When there was no answer, he checked the backyard again, the empty street.
"Rachel!"
Saul ran in to call the neighbors, but suddenly there was the slightest of sounds from the deep closet Saray used for storage. Saul quietly opened the screen panel. Rachel sat beneath the hanging clothes, Saray's antique pine box open between her legs. The floor was littered with photos and hollow chips of Rachel as a high school student, Rachel on the day she set off for college, Rachel standing in front of a carved mountainside on Hyperion. Rachel's research comlog lay whispering on the 4-year-old Rachel's lap. Saul's heart seized at the familiar sound of the confident young woman's voice.
"Daddy,"
said the child on the floor, her own voice a tiny, frightened echo of the voice on the comlog,
"you never told me that I had a sister."
"You don't, little one." Rachel frowned.
"Is this Mommy, when she was not so big?"
"Uh-uh, can't be. Her name's Rachel, too," she says. "How can—"
"It's all right," he said. "I'll explain." Saul realized that the phone was ringing in the living room. Had been ringing. "Just a moment, sweetie. I'll be right back." The hollow that formed above the pit was of a man Saul had never seen before. Saul did not activate his own imager, eager to get rid of the caller.
"Yes?"
he said abruptly.
"M. Weintraub? M. Weintraub, who used to live on Barnard's World, currently in the village of Dan on Hebron?"
Saul started to disconnect and then paused. Their access code was unfiled. Occasionally, a salesperson called from New Jerusalem, but off-world calls were rare. And Saul suddenly realized, his stomach feeling a stab of cold, it was past sundown on the Sabbath. Only emergency hollow calls were allowed.
Yes, said Saul.
M. Weintraub, said the man, staring blindly past Saul. There's been a terrible accident. When Rachel awoke, her father was sitting by the side of her bed. He looked tired. His eyes were red and his cheeks were gray with stubble above the line of his beard.
Good morning, Daddy.
Good morning, sweetheart. Rachel looked around and blinked. Some of her dolls and toys and things were there, but the room was not hers. The light was different. The air felt different. Her daddy looked different.
Where are we, Daddy?
We've gone on a trip, little one.
Where to?
It doesn't matter right now. Hop out, sweetie. Your bath is ready, and then we have to get dressed. A dark dress she had never seen before lay at the base of her bed. Rachel looked at the dress, and then back at her father.
Daddy, what's the matter? Where's Mommy?
Saul rubbed his cheek. It was the third morning since the accident. It was the day of the funeral. He had told her each of the preceding days, because he could not imagine lying to her then. It seemed the ultimate betrayal of both Saray and Rachel. But he did not think he could do it again. There's been an accident, Rachel, he said, his voice a pained rasp. Mommy died. We're going to go say goodbye to her today. Saul paused. He knew by now that it would take a minute for the fact of her mother's death to become real for Rachel. On the first day, he had not known if a 4-year-old could truly comprehend the concept of death. He knew now that Rachel could. Later, as he held the sobbing child, Saul tried to understand the accident he had described so briefly to her. EMVs were by far the safest form of personal transportation mankind had ever designed. Their lifters could fail, but, even so, the residual charge in the EM generators would allow the air car to descend safely from any altitude. The basic, fail-safe design of an EMV's collision avoidance equipment had not changed in centuries. But everything failed. In this case, it was a joyriding teenage couple in a stolen EMV outside the traffic lanes, accelerating to Mach 1.5, with all lights and transponders off to avoid detection, who defied all odds by colliding with Aunt Heather's ancient Vicken as it descended toward the Bassard City Opera House landing apron. Besides Tetha and Saray and the teenagers, three others died in the crash as pieces of falling vehicles cartwheeled into the crowded atrium of the Opera House itself. Saray.
Will we ever see Mommy again? Rachel asked between sobs.
She had asked this each time. I don't know, sweetheart, responded Saul truthfully. The funeral was at the family cemetery in Cates County on Barnard's World. The press did not invade the graveyard itself, but Teeps hovered beyond the trees and pressed against the black iron gate like an angry storm tide. Richard wanted Saul and Rachel to stay a few days, but Saul knew what pain would be inflicted on the quiet farmer if the press continued their assault. Instead, he hugged Richard, spoke briefly to the clamoring reporters beyond the fence, and fled to Hebron with a stunned and silent Rachel in tow. Newsteeps followed to New Jerusalem and then attempted to follow to Dan, but military police overrode their chartered EMVs, threw a dozen in jail as an example, and revoked the Farcaster visas of the rest. In the evening, Saul walked the ridgelines above the village while Judy watched his sleeping child. He found
that his dialogue with God was audible now, and he resisted the urge to shake his fist at the sky, to shout obscenities, to throw stones. Instead, he asked questions, always ending with, "Why?" There was no answer. Hebron's sun set behind distant ridges, and the rocks glowed as they gave up their heat. Saul sat on a boulder and rubbed his temples with his palms. Surrey. They had lived a full life, even with the tragedy of Rachel's illness hanging over them. It was too ironic that in Surrey's first hour of relaxation with her sister, Saul moaned aloud. The trap, of course, had been in their total absorption with Rachel's illness. Neither had been able to face the future beyond Rachel's death, disappearance. The world had hinged upon each day their child lived, and no thought had been given to the chance of accident, the perverse anti-logic of a sharp-edged universe. Saul was sure that Saray had considered suicide just as he had, but neither of them could ever have abandoned the other. Or Rachel. He had never considered the possibility of being alone with Rachel when... Saray. At that moment, Saul realized that the often angry dialogue which his people had been having with God for so many millennia had not ended with the death of old Earth, nor with the new diaspora, but continued still. He and Rachel and Saray had been part of it, were part of it now. He let the pain come. It filled him with the sharp-edged agony of resolve. Saul stood on the ridgeline and wept as darkness fell. In the morning, he was next to Rachel's bed when sunlight filled the room. "Good morning, Daddy." "Good morning, sweetheart." "Where are we, Daddy?" "We've gone on a trip. It's a pretty place." "Where's Mommy?" "She's with Aunt Tether today." "Will we see her tomorrow?" "Yes," said Saul. "Now let's get you dressed and I'll make breakfast." Saul began to petition the Church of the Shrike when Rachel turned 3. Travel to Hyperion was severely limited, and access to the time tombs had become all but impossible. Only the occasional Shrike pilgrimage sent people to that region. Rachel was sad that she had to be away from her mother on her birthday, but the visit of several children from the kibbutz distracted her a bit. Her big present was an illustrated book of fairy tales, which Saray had picked out in New Jerusalem months before. Saul read some of the stories to Rachel before bedtime. It had been 7 months since she could read any of the words herself. But she loved the stories, especially Sleeping Beauty, and made her father read it to her twice. "I'm going to show Mommy it when we get home," she said through a yawn as Saul turned out the overhead light. "Good night, kiddo," he said softly, pausing at the door. "Hey, Daddy." "Yes?" "Later, alligator." "Wild crocodile." Rachel giggled into her pillow. It was, Saul thought during the final 2 years, not so much different from watching a loved one falling into old age. Only worse. 1,000 times worse. Rachel's permanent teeth had fallen out over intervals between her 8th and 2nd birthdays. Baby teeth replaced them, but by her 18th month, half of these had receded into her jaw. Rachel's hair, always her one vanity, grew shorter and thinner. Her face lost its familiar structure as baby fat obscured the cheekbones and firm chin. Her coordination failed by degrees, noticeable at first in a sudden clumsiness as she handled a fork or pencil. On the day she could no longer walk, Saul put her down in her crib early and then went into his study to get thoroughly and quietly drunk. Language was the hardest for him. Her vocabulary loss was like the burning of a bridge between them, the severing of a final line of hope. It was some time after her second birthday, receded, that Saul tucked her in and, pausing in the doorway, said, "Later, alligator."
"Huh?"
"See you later, alligator."
Rachel giggled.
"You say, 'in a while, crocodile,'" said Saul. He told her what an alligator and crocodile were.
"In a while, alligator," giggled Rachel.
In the morning, she had forgotten. Saul took Rachel with him as he traveled the web, no longer caring about the newsteeps, petitioning the Shrike Church for pilgrimage rights, lobbying the Senate for a visa and access to forbidden areas on Hyperion, and visiting any research institute or clinic which might offer a cure. Months were lost while more medics admitted failure. When he fled back to Hebron, Rachel was 15 standard months old. In the ancient units used on Hebron, she weighed 25 pounds and measured 30 inches tall. She could no longer dress herself. Her vocabulary consisted of 25 words, of which her favorites were mommy and daddy. Saul loved carrying his daughter. There were times when the curve of her head against his cheek, her warmth against his chest, the smell of her skin, all worked to allow him to forget the fierce injustice of it all. At those times, Saul would have been temporarily at peace with the universe if only Saray had been there. As it was, there were temporary ceasefires in his angry dialogue with a god in whom he did not believe. "What possible reason can there be for this?" "What reason has been visible for all of the forms of pain suffered by humankind?" "Precisely," thought Saul, wondering if he had just won a point for the first time. He doubted it. The fact of a thing not being visible does not mean it does not exist. "That's clumsy. It shouldn't take three negatives to make a statement, especially to state something as non-profound as that."
"Precisely, Saul. You're beginning to get the drift of all this."
"What?" There was no answer to his thoughts. Saul lay in his house and listened to the desert wind blow. Rachel's last word was "Mama," uttered when she was just over 5 months old. She awoke in her crib and did not, could not, ask where she was. Her world was one of mealtimes, naps, and toys. Sometimes when she cried, Saul wondered if she was crying for her mother. Saul shopped in the small stores in Dan, taking the infant with him as he selected diapers, nursing packs, and the occasional new toy. The week before Saul left for Tau Ceti Center, Ephraim and the two other elders came to talk. It was evening, and the fading light glowed on Ephraim's bald scalp. "Saul, we're worried about you. The next few weeks will be hard. The women want to help. We want to help." Saul laid his hand on the older man's forearm. "It's appreciated, Ephraim. Everything the last few years is appreciated. This is our home now, too. Saray would have wanted me to say thank you. But we're leaving on Sunday. Rachel is going to get better." The three men on the long bench looked at one another. Avner said,
"They've found a cure?"
"No," said Saul. "But I've found a reason to hope."
"Hope is good," Robert said in cautious tones.
Saul grinned, his teeth white against the gray of his beard. "It had better be," he said. "Sometimes it is all we're given." The studio holocamera zoomed in for a close-up of Rachel as the infant sat cradled in Saul's arm on the set of Common Talk.
"So you're saying," said Devin Whiteshire, the show's host and third best-known face in the web datasphere, "that the Shrike Church's refusal to allow you to return to the Time Tombs, and the hegemony's tardiness in processing a visa, these things will doom your child to this extinction?"
"Precisely," said Saul. "The voyage to Hyperion cannot be made in under 6 weeks.
Rachel is now 12 weeks old. Any further delay by either the Shrike Church or the web bureaucracy will kill this child.
The studio audience stirred. Devin Whiteshire turned toward the nearest imaging remote. His craggy, friendly visage filled the monitor frame.
"This man doesn't know if he can save his child," said Whiteshire, his voice powerful with subtle feeling. "But all he asks is a chance. Do you think he and the baby deserve one? If so, access your planetary representatives and your nearest Church of the Shrike Temple. The number of your nearest temple should be appearing now."
He turned back to Saul. "We wish you luck, M. Weintraub. And," Whiteshire's large hand touched Rachel's cheek, "we wish you Godspeed, our young friend."
The monitor image held on Rachel until it faded to black. The Hawking effect caused nausea, vertigo, headache, and hallucinations. The first leg of the voyage was the 10-day transit to Parvati on the Hegemony torch ship HS Intrepid. Saul held Rachel and endured. They were the only people fully conscious aboard the warship. At first, Rachel cried, but after some hours she lay quietly in Saul's arms and stared up at him with large dark eyes. Saul remembered the day she was born. The medics had taken the infant from atop Saray's warm stomach and handed her to Saul. Rachel's dark hair was not much shorter then, her gaze no less profound. Eventually they slept from sheer exhaustion. Saul dreamed that he was wandering through a structure with columns the size of redwood trees and a ceiling lost to sight far above him. Red light bathed cool emptiness. Saul was surprised to find that he still carried Rachel in his arms. Rachel, as a child, had never been in his dream before. The infant looked up at him, and Saul felt the contact of her consciousness as surely as if she had spoken aloud. Suddenly, a different voice, immense and cold, echoed through the void. "Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." Saul hesitated and looked back to Rachel. The baby's eyes were deep and luminous as she looked up at her father. Saul felt the unspoken yes. Holding her tightly, he stepped forward into the darkness and raised his voice against the silence. "Listen, there will be no more offerings, neither child nor parent. There will be no more sacrifices for anyone other than our fellow human. The time of obedience and atonement is past." Saul listened. He could feel the pounding of his heart and Rachel's warmth against his arm. From somewhere high above, there came the cold sound of wind through unseen fissures. Saul cupped his hand to his mouth and shouted, "That's all! Now either leave us alone or join us as a father rather than a receiver of sacrifices. You have the choice of Abraham." Rachel stirred in his arms as a rumble grew out of the stone floor. Columns vibrated. The red gloom deepened and then winked out, leaving only darkness. From far away there came the boom of huge footsteps. Saul hugged Rachel to him as a violent wind roared past. There was a glimmer of light as both he and Rachel awoke on the HS Intrepid, outward bound for Parvati, to transfer to the tree ship Yggdrasil for the planet Hyperion. Saul smiled at his 7-week-old daughter. She smiled back. It was her last, or her first, smile.
The main cabin of the wind wagon was silent when the old scholar finished his story. Saul cleared his throat and took a drink of water from a crystal goblet. Rachel slept on in the makeshift cradle of the open drawer. The wind wagon rocked gently on its way, the rumble of the great wheel and the hum of the main gyroscope a lulling background noise.
"My God,"
Braun Lamia said softly. She started to speak again and then merely shook her head. Martin Silenus closed his eyes and said,
"Considering that all hatred driven hence, the soul recovers radical innocence and learns at last that it is self-delighting, self-appeasing, self-affrighting, and that its own sweet will is heaven's will. She can, though every face will scowl and every windy quarter howl or every bellows burst, be happy still."
Saul Weintraub asked,
"William Butler Yeats?"
Silenus nodded.
"A prayer for my daughter."
"I think I'm going up on deck for a breath of air before turning in,"
said the consul.
"Would anyone care to join me?"
Everyone did. The breeze of their passage was refreshing as the group stood on the quarterdeck and watched the darkened sea of grass rumble by. The sky was a great, star-splashed bowl above them, scarred by meteor trails. The sails and rigging creaked with a sound as old as human travel.
"I think we should post guards tonight,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"One person on watch while the others sleep. 2-hour intervals."
"I agree. I'll take the first watch."
"In the morning,"
began Cassad. "Look!" cried Father Hoyt. They followed his pointing arm. Between the blaze of constellations, colored fireballs flared. Green, violet, orange, green again, illuminating the great plain of grass around them like flashes of heat lightning. The stars and meteor trails paled to insignificance beside the sudden display. "Explosions?" ventured the priest.
"Space battle,"
said Cassad.
"Cislunar, fusion weapons."
He went below quickly.
"The tree,"
said Hetmastin, pointing to a speck of light which moved among the explosions like an ember floating through a fireworks display. Cassad returned with his powered binoculars and handed them around.
"Ousters? Is it the invasion?"
"Ousters, almost certainly. But almost as certainly, just a scouting raid. See the clusters? Those are hegemony missiles being exploded by the ouster ram scout's countermeasures."
The binoculars came to the consul. The flashes were quite clear now, an expanding cumulus of flame. He could see the speck and long blue tail of at least 2 scout ships fleeing from the hegemony pursuers.
"I don't think,"
began Cassad, and then stopped as the ship and sails and sea of grass glowed bright orange in reflected glare.
"Dear Christ," whispered Father Hoyt. "They've hit the tree ship."
The consul swept the glasses left. The growing nimbus of flames could be seen with the naked eye. But in the binoculars, the kilometer-long trunk and branch array of the Yggdrasil was visible for an instant as it burned and flared, long tendrils of flame arcing away into space as the containment fields failed and the oxygen burned. The orange cloud pulsed, faded, and fell back on itself as the trunk became visible for a final second, even as it glowed and broke up, like the last long ember in a dying fire. Nothing could have survived. The tree ship Yggdrasil, with its crew and complement of clones and semi-sentient Urg drivers, was dead. The consul turned toward Hetmastin and belatedly held out the binoculars.
"I'm so sorry."
The tall Templar did not take the glasses. Slowly he lowered his gaze from the skies, pulled forward his cowl, and went below without a word. The death of the tree ship was the final explosion. When 10 minutes had passed and no more flares had disturbed the night, Braun Lamia spoke.
"Do you think they got them?"
"The ousters?"
said Kassad.
Probably not. The scout ships are built for speed and defense. They're light minutes away by now.
Did they go after the tree ship on purpose?
Asked Silenus. The poet sounded very sober.
I think not. Merely a target of opportunity.
Target of opportunity,
echoed Saul Weintraub. The scholar shook his head.
I'm going to get a few hours' sleep before sunrise.
One by one, the others went below. When only Kassad and the consul were left on deck, the consul said,
Where should I stand watch?
Make a circuit. From the main corridor at the base of the ladder, you can see all of the stateroom doors and the entrance to the mess and galley. Come above and check the gangway and decks. Keep the lanterns lit. Do you have a weapon?
The consul shook his head. Kassad handed over his death wand.
It's on tight beam, about half a meter at 10 meters range. Don't use it unless you're sure that there's an intruder. The rough plate that slides forward is the safety. It's on.
The consul nodded, making sure that his finger stayed away from the firing stud.
I'll relieve you in 2 hours,
said Kassad. He checked his comm log.
It'll be sunrise before my watch is over.
Kassad looked at the sky as if expecting the Yggdrasil to reappear and continue its firefly path across the sky. Only the stars glowed back. On the northeastern horizon, a moving mass of black promised a storm. Kassad shook his head.
A waste,
he said, and went below. The consul stood there a while and listened to the wind in the canvas, the creak of rigging, and the rumble of the wheel. After a while, he went to the railing and stared at darkness while he thought. 5. Sunrise over the sea of grass was a thing of beauty. The consul watched from the highest point on the aft deck. After his watch, he had tried to sleep, given it up, and come onto deck to watch the night fade into day. The storm front had covered the sky with low clouds, and the rising sun lit the world with brilliant gold reflected from above and below. The wind wagon sails and lines and weathered planks glowed in the brief benediction of light in the few minutes before the sun was blocked by the ceiling of clouds, and color flowed out of the world once again. The wind which followed this curtain closing was chill. As if it had blown down from the snowy peaks of the Bridal Range, just visible as a dark blur on the northeastern horizon. Braun Lamia and Martin Silenus joined the consul on the aft deck, each nursing a cup of coffee from the galley. The wind whipped and tugged at the rigging. Braun Lamia's thick mass of curls fluttered around her face like a dark nimbus.
Morning,
muttered Silenus, squinting out over his coffee cup at the wind-rippled sea of grass.
Good morning,
replied the consul, amazed at how alert and refreshed he felt for not having slept at all the night before.
We have a headwind, but the wagon still seems to be making decent time. We'll definitely be to the mountains before nightfall.
Commented Silenus, and buried his nose in the coffee cup.
I didn't sleep at all last night, just for thinking about M. Weintraub's story.
I don't think,
began the poet, and then broke off as Weintraub came onto deck, his baby peering over the lip of an infant carrier sling on his chest.
Good morning, everyone,
said Weintraub, looking around and taking a deep breath.
Brisk, isn't it?
Fucking freezing,
said Silenus.
North of the mountains it'll be even worse.
I think I'll go down to get a jacket,
said Lamia. But before she could move, there came a single, shrill cry from the deck below. Blood! There was, indeed, blood everywhere. Hetmastine's cabin was strangely neat. Bed unslept in, travel trunk and other boxes stacked precisely in one corner, robe folded over a chair. Except for the blood, which covered great sections of the deck, bulkhead, and overhead. The six pilgrims crowded just inside the entrance, reluctant to go farther in.
"I was passing on my way to the upper deck," said Father Hoyt, his voice a strange monotone. "The door was slightly ajar. I caught a glimpse of the blood on the wall."
"Is it blood?"
demanded Martin Silenus. Braun Lamia stepped into the room, ran a hand through a thick smear on the bulkhead, and raised her fingers to her lips.
"It's blood."
She looked around, walked to the wardrobe, looked briefly among the empty shelves and hangers, and then went to the small porthole. It was latched and bolted from the inside. Lennar Hoyt looked more ill than usual and staggered to a chair.
"Is he dead, then?"
"We don't know a damn thing, except that Captain Mastine isn't in his room, and a lot of blood is."
She wiped her hand on her pant leg.
"The thing to do now is search the ship thoroughly."
"Precisely," said Colonel Cassad. "And if we do not find the captain?"
Braun Lamia opened the porthole. Fresh air dissipated the slaughterhouse smell of blood and brought in the rumble of the wheel and the rustle of grass under the hull.
"If we don't find Captain Mastine, then we assume that he either left the ship under his own will or was taken off."
"But the blood..."
"Doesn't prove anything. M. Lamy is correct. We don't know Mastine's blood type or genotype. Did anyone see or hear anything?"
There was silence, except for negative grunts and the shaking of heads. Martin Silenus looked around.
"Don't you people recognize the work of our friend the Shrike when you see it?"
"We don't know that. Maybe someone wanted us to think that it was the Shrike's doing."
"That doesn't make sense," said Hoyt, still gasping for air.
"Nonetheless, we'll search in twos. Who has weapons besides myself?"
"I do,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"I have extras if needed."
"No," said Hoyt.
The poet shook his head. Saul Weintraub had returned to the corridor with his child. Now he looked in again.
"I have nothing."
"No,"
said the consul. He had returned the death wand to Cassad when his shift ended 2 hours before first light.
"All right. The priest will come with me on the lower deck. Silenus, go with the colonel. Search the mid-deck. M. Weintraub, you and the consul check everything above. Look for anything out of the ordinary, any sign of struggle."
"One question,"
said Silenus.
"What?"
"Who the hell elected you queen of the prom?"
"I'm a private investigator,"
said Lamia, leveling her gaze on the poet. Martin Silenus shrugged.
"Hoyt here is a priest of some forgotten religion. That doesn't mean we have to genuflect when he says mass."
"All right,"
sighed Braun Lamia.
"I'll give you a better reason."
The woman moved so fast that the consul almost missed the action in a blink. 1 second, she was standing by the open port, and in the next she was halfway across the stateroom, lifting Martin Silenus off the deck with one arm, her massive hand around the poet's thin neck.
"How about that you do the logical thing because it's the logical thing to do?" "Good,"
said Lamia without emotion, and dropped the poet to the deck. Silenus staggered a meter and almost sat on Father Hoyt.
"Here,"
said Cassad, returning with 2 small neural stunners. He handed one to Saul Weintraub.
"What do you have?"
Cassad asked Lamia. The woman reached into a pocket of her loose tunic and produced an ancient pistol. Cassad looked at the relic for a moment and then nodded.
"Stay with your partner. Don't shoot anything unless it's positively identified and unquestionably threatening."
"That describes the bitch I plan to shoot,"
said Silenus, still massaging his throat. Braun Lamia took a half-step toward the poet. Fedman Cassad said,
"Shut up. Let's get this over with."
Silenus followed the colonel out of the stateroom. Saul Weintraub approached the consul, handed him the stunner.
I don't want to hold this thing with Rachel. Shall we go up?
The consul took the weapon and nodded. The wind wagon held no further sign of Templar, voice of the tree, Het Mastin. After an hour of searching, the group met in the stateroom of the missing man. The blood there seemed darker and drier.
"Is there a chance that we missed something?" said Father Hoyt. "Secret passages? Hidden compartments?"
"There's a chance,"
said Cassad.
"But I swept the ship with heat and motion sensors. If there's anything else on board larger than a mouse, I can't find it."
"If you had these sensors, why the fuck did you have us crawling through bilge and byways for an hour?"
"Because the right equipment or apparel can hide a man from a heat and beat search."
"So, in answer to my question," said Hoyt, pausing a second as a visible wave of pain passed through him, "with the right equipment or apparel, Captain Mastin might be hiding in a secret compartment somewhere."
"Possible, but improbable. My guess is that he's no longer aboard."
"The Shrike,"
said Martin Silenus in a disgusted tone. It was not a question.
"Perhaps. Colonel, you and the consul were on watch through those 4 hours. Are you sure that you heard and saw nothing?"
Both men nodded.
"The ship was quiet. I would have heard a struggle even before I went on watch."
"And I didn't sleep after my watch. My room shared a bulkhead with Mastin's. I heard nothing."
"Well, we've heard from the two men who were creeping around in the dark with weapons when the poor shit was killed. They say they're innocent. Next case."
"If Mastin was killed, it was with no death wand. No silent modern weapon I know throws that much blood around. There were no gunshots heard, no bullet holes found, so I presume M. Lamia's automatic pistol is not suspect. If this is Captain Mastin's blood, then I would guess an edged weapon was used."
"The Shrike is an edged weapon."
Lamia moved to the small stack of luggage.
"Debating isn't going to solve anything. Let's see if there's anything in Mastin's belongings."
Father Hoyt raised a hesitant hand. "That's, well, private, isn't it? I don't think we have the right." Brawn Lamia crossed her arms.
"Look, Father, if Mastin's dead, it doesn't matter to him. If he's still alive, looking through this stuff might give us some idea where he was taken. Either way, we have to try to find a clue."
Hoyt looked dubious but nodded. In the end, there was little invasion of privacy. Mastin's first trunk held only a few changes of linen and a copy of Muir's Book of Life. The second bag held 100 separately wrapped seedlings, flash-dried and nestled in moist soil.
"Templars must plant at least 100 offspring of the Eternal Tree on whatever world they visit,"
explained the consul.
"The shoots rarely take, but it's a ritual."
Brawn Lamia moved toward the large metal box which had sat at the bottom of the pile.
"Don't touch that!"
"Why not?"
"It's a Mobius cube,"
responded Colonel Cassad for the consul.
"A carbon-carbon shell set around a zero-impedance containment field, folded back on itself."
"So? Mobius cubes seal artifacts and stuff in. They don't explode or anything."
"No, but what they contain may explode. May already have exploded, for that matter."
"A cube that size could hold a kiloton nuclear explosion in check, as long as it was boxed during the nanosecond of ignition,"
added Fedmon Cassad. Lamia scowled at the trunk.
"Then how do we know that something in there didn't kill Mastin?"
Cassad pointed to a faintly glowing green strip along the trunk's only seam.
"It's sealed. Once unsealed, a Mobius cube has to be reactivated at a place where containment fields can be generated. Whatever's in there didn't harm Captain Mastin."
"So there's no way to tell?"
"I have a good guess,"
said the consul. The others looked at him. Rachel began to cry, and Saul pulled a heating strip on a nursing pack.
"Remember at Edge yesterday when M. Mastin made a big deal out of the cube? He talked about it as if it were a secret weapon."
"A weapon?"
"A weapon?
Of course,"
Kassad said suddenly.
An Urg.
Urg?
Martin Silenus stared at the small crate.
I thought Urgs were those force-field critters that Templars use on their tree ships.
They are. The things were found about 3 centuries ago, living on asteroids around Aldebaran. Bodies about as big as a cat's spine. Mostly a piezoelectric nervous system sheathed in silicon gristle. But they feed on, and manipulate, force fields as large as those generated by small spin ships.
So how do you get all that into such a little box?
Asked Silenus, staring at the Mobius cube.
Mirrors?
In a sense. The thing's field would be damped. Neither starving nor feeding. Rather like cryogenic fugue for us. Plus, this must be a small one, a cub, so to speak.
Lamia ran her hand along the metal sheath.
Templars control these things? Communicate with them?
Yes. No one is quite sure how. It's one of the Brotherhood's secrets. But Hetma Steen must have been confident that the Urg would help him with...
The Shrike!
Finished Martin Silenus.
The Templar thought that this energy imp would be his secret weapon when he faced the Lord of Pain.
The poet laughed. Father Hoyt cleared his throat. The Church has accepted the hegemony's ruling that these creatures, Urgs, are not sentient beings, and thus not candidates for salvation.
Oh, they're sentient, all right, Father,
said the consul.
They perceive things far better than we could ever imagine. But if you mean intelligent, self-aware, then you're dealing with something along the lines of a smart grasshopper. Are grasshoppers candidates for salvation?
Hoyt said nothing. Braun Lamia said,
Well, evidently Captain Mastine thought this thing was going to be his salvation. Something went wrong.
She looked around at the blood-stained bulkheads and at the drying stains on the deck.
Let's get out of here.
The wind wagon tacked into increasingly strong winds as the storm approached from the northeast. Ragged banners of clouds raced white beneath the low, gray ceiling of storm front. Grasses whipped and bent under gusts of cold wind. Ripples of lightning illuminated the horizon and were followed by rolls of thunder sounding like warning shots across the wind wagon's bow. The pilgrims watched in silence until the first icy raindrops drove them below to the large stateroom in the stern.
This was in his robe pocket,
said Braun Lamia, holding up a slip of paper with the number 5 on it.
So Mastine would have told his story next,
muttered the consul. Martin Silenus tilted his chair until his back touched the tall windows. Stormlight made his satyr's features appear slightly demonic.
There's another possibility. Perhaps someone who hasn't spoken yet had the fifth spot and killed the Templar to trade places.
Lamia stared at the poet.
That would have to be the consul or me,
she said, her voice flat. Silenus shrugged. Braun Lamia pulled another piece of paper from her tunic.
I have number 6. What would I have achieved? I go next anyway.
Then perhaps it's what Mastine would have said that needed to be silenced,
said the poet. He shrugged again.
Personally, I think the Shrike has begun harvesting us. Why did we think we'd be allowed to get to the tombs when the thing's been slaughtering people halfway from here to Keats?
This is different, said Saul Weintraub. This is the Shrike pilgrimage.
So?
In the silence that followed, the consul walked to the windows. Wind-driven torrents of rain obscured the sea and rattled the leaded panes. The wagon creaked and leaned heavily to starboard as it began another leg of its tack.
M. Lamia, do you want to tell your story now?
Lamia folded her arms and looked at the rain-streaked glass.
No. Let's wait until we get off this damned ship It stinks of death.
The wind wagon reached the port of Pilgrim's Rest in mid-afternoon, but the storm and tired light made it feel like late evening to the weary passengers. The consul had expected representatives from the Shrike Temple to meet them here at the beginning of the penultimate stage of their journey. But Pilgrim's Rest appeared to the consul to be as empty as Edge had been. The approach to the foothills and the first sight of the Bridal Range was as exciting as any landfall, and brought all six of the would-be pilgrims on deck, despite the cold rain which continued to fall. The foothills were sheer and sensuous, their brown curves and sudden upthrustings contrasting strongly with the verdant monochrome of the sea of grass. The 9,000-meter peaks beyond were only hinted at by gray and white plains, soon intersected by low clouds, but even so truncated were powerful to behold. The snow line came down to a point just above the collection of burned-out hovels and cheap hotels which had been Pilgrim's Rest.
"If they destroyed the tramway, we're finished,"
muttered the consul. The thought of it, forbidden until now, made his stomach turn over.
"I see the first five towers,"
said Colonel Cassad, using his powered glasses.
"They seem intact."
"Any sign of a car?"
"No. Wait, yes. There's one in the gate at the station platform."
"Any moving?"
asked Martin Silenus, who obviously understood how desperate their situation would be if the tramway was not intact.
"No."
The consul shook his head. Even in the worst weather with no passengers, the cars had been kept moving to keep the great cables flexed and free of ice. The six of them had their luggage on deck even before the wind wagon reefed its sails and extended a gangplank. Each now wore a heavy coat against the elements, Cassad in force-issue thermoflage cape, Braunlamia in a long garment called a trench coat for reasons long forgotten, Martin Silenus in thick furs, which rippled now sable, now gray, with the vagaries of wind. Father Hoyt in long black, which made him more of a scarecrow figure than ever. Saul Weintraub in a thick goose-down jacket, which covered him and the child. And the consul, in the thinning but serviceable greatcoat his wife had given him some decades before.
"What about Captain Mastine's things?"
asked Saul as they stood at the head of the gangplank. Cassad had gone ahead to reconnoiter the village.
"I brought them up. We'll take them with us."
"It doesn't seem right somehow. Just going on, I mean. There should be some service, some recognition that a man has died."
"May have died,"
reminded Lamia, easily lifting a 40-kilo backpack with one hand. Hoyt looked incredulous.
"Do you really believe that M. Mastine might be alive?"
"No,"
said Lamia. Snowflakes settled on her black hair. Cassad waved to them from the end of the dock, and they carried their luggage off the silent wind wagon. No one looked back.
"Empty?"
called Lamia as they approached the colonel. The tall man's cloak was still fading from its gray and black chameleon mode.
"Empty."
"Bodies?"
"No,"
said Cassad. He turned towards Saul and the consul.
"Did you get the things from the galley?"
Both men nodded.
"What things?"
asked Silenus.
"A week's worth of food,"
said Cassad, turning to look up the hill toward the tramway station. For the first time, the consul noticed the long assault weapon in the crook of the colonel's arm, barely visible under the cloak.
"We're not